Hey friends, welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am Jason Belindy, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that is John Rauhaus playing in the background. Today on the podcast, I'm talking to a dear friend of ours, Andy Powers from Taylor Guitars. Andy is no stranger to this podcast. He is also no stranger to our print magazine. He's actually written for it, and he's been featured in it. I wrote a feature on Andy just a couple issues ago in the Fretboard Journal's 42nd issue. For the last 10 years or so, Andy has totally reinvigorated and reimagined all sorts of amazing things over at Taylor Guitars. He's sort of their head of engineering, R&D, mad science. I don't know what to call it. I don't know that he has an official title. He probably does. I just didn't ask him about it. But for almost a decade, he's been slowly but surely going through nearly every Taylor model imaginable and making it sound even better, rethinking all sorts of stuff. He came up with the V-Class bracing system, which was huge and continues to have an enormous effect on the sound and playability of those Taylor guitars. And his most recent unveiling was the Taylor Grand Pacific series of guitars. This is something that was just unveiled at the 2019 NAMM show. Andy came up here a few weeks prior to that. He wanted to show off the guitars, touch base with us, talk to us. We recorded this podcast in early January here in Seattle at our headquarters. And since Andy came all the way up from California to Seattle, we also threw a pretty fun reader meetup at a local nano brewery here down the street from us. And we had a ton of Fretboard Journal readers attend. Andy actually gave them a sneak peek at these guitars and answered all of their questions and even gave us a little mini concert. And it was a ton of fun. So now that NAMM is over, the guitar's officially been announced, I can publish this podcast. I think you will like it. I know a lot has been said about these guitars, but every time I talk to Andy, I learn something. He is such an amazing thinker and communicator and has so many ideas and is also just a ridiculously talented player. So always fun to talk to Andy. In other NAMM news, we have just posted a photo essay on fretboardjournal.com of some of our other NAMM highlights besides the Taylor guitars. Check that out if you haven't yet. Just go to fretboardjournal.com and you will see it in our photo essay tab. There was all sorts of cool stuff there. It was great to run into a bunch of Fretboard Journal writers and photographers. It's great to see so many people we've featured in the magazine. Amazing guitars all around across the board. I don't even know where to begin. Some incredible Martin guitars. Loudon had their new Ed Sheeran model, or I guess it's a whole line of guitars out. Got to hang out at the Santa Cruz booth. Got to go see all the new Fender things. Probably the biggest news of all was just how nice the guitars at the new and improved Gibson booth room was. You know, Gibson's undergone a incredible and much needed management change, and the folks who are in charge now seem to really know what they're doing. I mean, they had one of Orville's old guitars on display, as well as the shipping ledgers from the 50s, and all of the guitars looked incredible. They are doing some incredible, the relicking, aging they're doing on their new electrics. Some of their new electrics looked so spot on. I was really blown away, and I didn't really get to hear the acoustics coming out of the Montana plant because at NAMM, the sound is so loud, you don't really hear anything. But I look forward to trying those out soon as well. What else can I tell you? The Fretboard Journal's 43rd issue is out now. Check it out if you haven't yet. If you've enjoyed this podcast, if you enjoy hearing from folks like Andy, you will love the Fretboard Journal print magazine because it is filled with 100-plus pages of stories from some of the brightest and most unique minds in the world of guitars, and that's really our focus, is educating you guys and turning you on to the cool stuff. In that issue is Molly Tuttle, George Loudon, an incredible story on the amazing bluegrass guitarist Billy Strings, Nick Drake. There's a story on Nick Drake's guitars in there, and a lot more. Fretboard Journal 43. It's at newsstands now, but if you really want to support us, order it straight from us because that way it eliminates the middleman. And if you really, really want to support us, subscribe to the Fretboard Journal at fretboardjournal.com. And if you use the coupon code PODCAST, I will take $5 off your order. And if you order within the next 4 or 5 days, we will start you off with that 43rd issue at no extra cost. So please, please, please do that. Another way you can support the podcast is just by going over to iTunes and leaving us a review if you like these conversations that we have every single Friday. Leave us a review, 5 stars, please, if you could, and share it with your friends. We are loving all the podcasts that we're doing. In addition to the Fretboard Journal podcast, we have the monthly Luthier on Luthier podcast hosted by Michael Bashkin. And we also have our brand new podcast, The Truth About Vintage Amps, which is where I get to play the straight man and ask amp repair guru Skip Simmons all sorts of questions from you guys. And we are having a blast doing that. It's been getting a tremendous response. I'm being flooded with questions from all of you listeners. We've gotten more feedback on the AMP podcast than anything else pretty much we've done. I think 10,000 of you have downloaded it so far, and we're just like a month and a half into it, which is amazing. So check that out. Even if you don't think you need to know anything more about vintage amps or amplification or any of that stuff, give episode 1 a try, because chances are you're going to get sucked in as I did. I just love learning about music and how music is made, and Skip is a fountain of knowledge, and I suddenly have found myself looking at reverb listings for Fender Twins and Supros and all sorts of crazy stuff. So The Truth About Vintage Amps with Skip Simmons is our latest podcast. I hope you will check that out. All right, no plugs today. If anybody does want to sponsor the Fretboard Journal podcast, reach out to me at jason@fretboardjournal.com. We are looking for some brands we can partner with for 2019 and help share your story. But in the meantime, here is my chat with Andy Powers of Taylor Guitars.
Have you ever thought about some of the experiences that you've had in life and gone, man, you really could make a movie out of this because the truth is stranger than fiction?
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's some of the things you run into, you go, I couldn't make this up if I tried.
Yeah. You're not going to tell me the story, though.
Not that one. I got some other good ones, but there was... I kind of have to just lead into them.
All right. You don't have to tell me. Thanks for coming, Andy.
Hey, it's my pleasure to be here. This is fun. It's fun. You guys have all kinds of cool instruments, cool sound-making things. This is great.
We try to make noise. So, we've got some guitars that I guess I'm not even allowed to talk about till after NAMM, but we'll make this air after NAMM.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now it's after NAMM. We've got a time machine.
It's nice. The spring is in the air. It's nice. Yeah, it's nice that it's warming up and the days are getting longer.
It's true. What, 4 minutes more each day?
Yeah. So tell me about these.
Well, these guitars, we call them the Grand Pacifics, but really, it's a different mentality than a lot of the guitars that we've made or that Taylor has made in the past. It's a whole different approach.
So, more off, you know, at first glance, more dreadnought-y.
Yeah, I guess you call it a dreadnought. I mean, talking about dreadnoughts, that's scary. That's kind of like talking about the birds and the bees with your kids, you know? It's full of landmines all over.
Yeah, you can't do any... You can only do wrong.
Pretty much. But, okay, you think about where dreadnoughts came from, and I'm not even sure what you could call a dreadnought or dread yes. I mean, Gibson always called their slope-shoulder dreadnoughts or round-shoulder dreadnoughts, they were jumbos. I mean, that's where the J45 or Southern Jumbo or Advanced Jumbo, that's where it comes from.
Yeah.
You know, so they built their jumbo guitars that we guitar players like to refer to as dreadnoughts. And Martin's got their cool dreadnoughts. And at one point before the 14 fret neck, that looked a lot like a Gibson in some ways.
Sure.
And then kind of turned into what it is now. There's all kinds of cool guitars. So these ones, I had wanted to build something that was a different flavor than what we were working on at Taylor at the time. It was 2014. Yeah, 2014. We had launched our 800 series guitars, like this redesigned 800 series.
Yep.
And they were super cool.
Mm-hmm.
Love those guitars. But we had thrown like every cool guitar making trick you could think of at them.
Mm-hmm.
Like high glue, ultra thin finishes, all this optimized stuff to like wring all the little bits and pieces out of one of those guitars. And we did a pretty good job. They sounded really good. Players loved them. And, you know, as a guitar maker, you're not going to leave well enough alone.
Sure.
I thought, well, I'm not dead yet. I don't want to be done just there.
Yeah.
There's other stuff I'd like to try. And so at the time I was working on our house a lot. Maren and I had, we'd bought what was left of an old little flower farm with this little shack of a house.
Yeah.
By shack, I mean like the shackiest little shack.
Yeah.
You know, it had started life as an army barrack, got moved there during World War II, kind of got used as a flop house for the workers on this little flower farm and all the stuff. So it had kind of a funny background. So nights
is it haunted?
No, not anymore.
Okay.
Back then it might have been.
Okay.
It was a pretty strange little shack.
Okay.
But I was spending a lot of time working on this thing, tearing it apart, rebuilding it so we could, you know, move the kids in and everything. And I was listening to a lot of bluegrass because that's kind of what I grew up with. Mm-hmm. My dad's a carpenter and so he was over a lot helping us. And we were listening to all these old records, a lot of old Doc Watson stuff. And of course the Tony Rice records, a lot of Ricky Skaggs and David Grisman records, all this really fun music. The Circle B Unbroken records got, those still get a lot of airplay. Mm-hmm. Going, you know, in some of these cases, I've actually worked on these guitars that made these sounds. And the guitar in person doesn't really sound like this record. And I like the record better.
Mm-hmm.
Because on the record, you know, you get all your issues dealt with.
Sure.
You know, you get everything's cleaned up. It's all kind of compressed nicely and fixed. And everything fits together with the other instruments. And does a really good job presenting a song. It'd be cool to build a guitar that could just do that. I mean, you think of what a vintage, what a vintage flat top sounds like. Yeah. If you ask somebody to describe it, it's going to have a million different words, and they all seem like they're contradictory.
Yeah.
I mean, how many times have you heard somebody describe a vintage flat top by any maker as warm and bright or clear and dark?
Sure.
Or woody, and you go, how is it? I mean,
a big chunk of my day is just doing search and delete for the word canon, because that'll show up in about 18 every Fretboard Journal story 18 times unless, yeah, I remove it.
Yeah,
not that our writers, you know, they're great writers, but yeah, there are these words that get tossed around.
Really, like Richard Wagner. I remember seeing like a kind of a cartoon that had run after one of his performances. He had written this huge, giant masterwork. And he was one of the first guys to use a triple F,
you know,
dynamics marking in one of his scores. And I saw this drawing of him, and he had an actual cannon hidden in his orchestra in the percussion section.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that's pretty funny in a music nerd way.
Yeah.
You go, okay, well, cannon.
Yeah.
Yeah. A guitar that projects well. Okay, I get it.
Yeah.
But I wanted to build some guitars that kind of, they just have this thing. They're not really, like, they don't take themselves too seriously.
Mm-hmm.
They're just guitars that are good for playing songs with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of your fallback and familiar territory, but with some of those issues dealt with.
Yeah.
That was actually where the V idea started. Wasn't really meant to be or at least I didn't think of it initially as a modern guitar thing. It was trying to isolate some different physical attributes of a flat top acoustic guitar.
Okay.
And see if I could control them a little better to make a guitar do all these different things that seem like they're contradictory.
Yeah.
And, you know, I built this first guitar and went, oh, I'm an idiot. How come I didn't think of this sooner?
Yes.
It actually does some pretty cool stuff. The intonation thing, man, that threw a lot of people, even a lot of guitar making friends. I'd tell them about that over the last couple of years, and they'd be scratching their heads going like, you're doing what? You know, you're changing intonation with the bracing on the inside of a guitar? Like, you've been drinking too much coffee or something. No. It's like this. I mean, the way I came into it, for years, I'd build a solid body electric guitar. Repair one, set one up or something. And you go, like when you were putting your Telecaster together.
Yeah.
There's kind of like a tune-up list that you go through. So you set your, you get your frets right, you get your nut slots right, you set your string height, you get your pickup height right, your truss rod relief, everything kind of dialed in. And yeah. then finally, you set your string compensation. It's like yeah. the last thing you do, right?
Yeah. Well, to be clear, I haven't done any of that stuff on my Telecaster you're talking about. But yes, I would agree that most people, there would be a checklist. Yes.
Okay, so you go through this process and you realize by the time the thing is done, it's glorious. It's so good.
Yeah.
You play chords all over the fingerboard. It's just good.
Mm-hmm.
They're clear. They're accurate. All the notes work really good. It's super fun.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd set a guitar up, like a solid body electric guitar, and I'd use, you know, Peterson strobe tuner and get everything dialed, and it would be gloriously in tune.
Mm-hmm.
When I'd build one of my archtop guitars, I'd do the same thing. You go through this kind of this final tune up, and you're looking at this really carefully tuned acoustic body with the tops and back plates carved just exactly right. You get the frets right and the relief and everything dialed. And finally, you get the saddle made just so. You set the thing up, set the string compensation, and it would play gloriously in tune.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, octaves would be great. All the chord voicings high on the fingerboard. Everything would just be great. I'd go to work on a flat top acoustic guitar, and I would work to the same degree of accuracy using the same tools. And at the time the thing was done, it just wasn't as in tune.
Hmm.
You know, what the heck?
Yeah.
Like, I'm working to the same degree of accuracy. What is wrong? Why is this just not as in tune?
Yeah.
It took me a long time to figure it out, or to figure that out. And then I realized, oh, well, this guitar body, the way a flat top guitar body moves, can't ever perfectly replicate the notes that we want to play.
Yeah.
I mean, as it is, we're working with equal temperament tuning, so everything's a little shifted so that nothing's totally perfect, but it's acceptable. It's
yeah.
good. It's pretty close. It's almost impossible to get a body to agree with that.
Yeah.
So what'll happen is a guitar body, a flat top guitar, will give you the closest thing that it has to the note you played. And when you get two frequencies, it's kind of a little physics problem, but if you have a note, let's say you play an A440, and this body is capable of resonating at, let's say, 442,
mm-hmm.
those notes are pretty close, so they're gonna set each other off and they'll start moving. But those two are like magnets with opposing poles. They actually push each other apart unless they're dead on. And so this thing, it'll give you the closest note that it can.
Yeah.
But it's not going to be quite on.
Yeah.
And when you get it close, it tends to actually drive it worse and worse.
Yeah.
So it's this funny conundrum. That's actually, that's why a lot of double course instruments are so difficult to tune. I mean, you constantly see 12-string guitar players and mandolin players playing with those octave courses.
Yeah.
To try and get them exactly on. Is as soon as you get one that's close to the other, it wants to shift the pitch of the first one.
Ah, yeah.
So it's really hard to get them to settle into a perfect unison.
Have you made a V-class 12-string?
I have. Not out in the wild yet.
And?
It's really fun.
Yeah.
You'll see them.
Does it solve some of the aforementioned issues? Or
it's so fun. Yeah. It is. It's really unique because it starts to feel almost more like a good mandolin in a way.
Yeah.
Where you're hearing like a very uniform, clear voice. It's a mm-hmm. really cool thing. So at some point in the future, we don't have the tools to make them yet. I'm still kind of playing with that idea a little.
So I keep coming back to, and you're going to be able to, you're going to be able to elaborate on this better than I can, but you're talking about the influence or some of the problems that you didn't have with the arch top. And then you're having, talking about how the mandolin shape, you know, is a little bit closer to perfect than the typical 12-string guitar. I keep going in my head. I'm like, well, of an arch top and a mandolin, it's a more organic, flowy shape. And I know that waves have kind of influenced.
Yeah.
Like, is that what it really comes down to? Is like a typical guitar is just, it's just too rigid in some way?
It's too flexible in some ways.
Okay.
So it's the basic thing, the basic idea behind the V guitars.
Yeah.
Is that you're not trying to balance the guitar's inherent need for strength and the guitar's inherent need for flexibility to make volume. Okay, that's typically what you're doing, is you're, you kind of meld the two and go, yeah, it's strong enough, but it's weak enough to sound good.
Got it.
That's why we have, you know, kind of wives' tales, like a great guitar is on the verge of blowing apart.
That's always been talked about, yeah.
Okay. Well, there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah.
You go, yeah, that's a pretty happy balance point.
Yeah.
But it can be a frustrating balance point, because when you're really working on that knife edge,
yeah,
that means that you can't stray too far and get any more of one thing without radically altering the other aspects.
Yeah.
So with these V guitars, essentially they're working more like an electric guitar or more like an archtop guitar.
Yeah.
Where they are really strong.
Got it.
You have a really strong, stable thing that makes for a lot of good sustain.
Yeah.
It makes for a pretty consistent voice across the whole spectrum. But other parts of the guitar are very flexible, so you can still make good volume out of it.
Yeah.
And the reason I think I'm an idiot for not thinking of it sooner is you go, oh, well, of course, you make it act more like an electric guitar or more like an archtop, you get to borrow some of the other things that you could do with those guitars that you,
sure,
you can't with a typical flat top. You go, yeah. Oh, yeah, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. So going back to that, the thought of, you know, everybody longs for the guitar that's on the verge of imploding but doesn't. And I think every guitar maker, whether it's some guy in his garage or Martin or Taylor or whomever, is worried about warranty and doesn't want the guitar to ever come back to them. You're kind of a kid in the candy store. You've got all this amazing stuff to work with. You have all these resources that most builders don't have. Have you been able to ride that wave of like, let's see how light and dangerous I can get with a guitar just for kicks?
Oh, yeah. Just for the heck of it.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the earliest V guitars.
Yeah.
That's by now, I guess, 5-ish, maybe 6 years old.
Okay.
Every couple of weeks, I loosen the strings and I go inside and start hacking away part of the guitar. Okay. I take a plane,
yeah,
just to see, like, when does this thing fall apart?
And
like at
not
what
yet?
Point it's still together.
Okay.
Still plays.
Is it bellying or anything or no?
Not really.
Okay.
Not yeah. really. I started really hacking away at it a while ago to go, oh, come on. Like, let's yeah. get this over with.
Does it sound better as you hack away?
No. At a certain point you start to introduce some pretty weird
Got it.
Stuff. And you go, yeah, it might be scientifically interesting, but I'm not interested in playing a song on it anymore. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound good for making music.
Yeah. So your thought with this new model was, you know, not to have it compared with insert famous dreadnought maker here. It was really a guitar that, you know, evokes songwriting and evokes...
Yeah, you know...
American, like, whatever you want to call, like,
man, I've worked
American.
On a lot of really great D18s and
yeah.
really great D28s and really cool J45s and Southern Jumbos. I love those guitars.
Sure.
Martin does an amazing job building a Martin.
Yeah.
I really think that's great.
Yeah.
Gibson does a job building a Gibson.
Yeah. We don't know how they're doing right now.
I don't know.
But hopefully they're doing well.
I wish them all the best because... Yeah. They are one of the iconic brands of American business history
yeah.
and American music. These guitars are great.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to replicate that. I don't want to knock that off. I don't want to build even a copy of it or an inspired thing of it.
Yeah.
It's like I love taking that shared past and the music that it's made, but I want to make something else that gives musicians a chance to make some cool music with.
Sure.
That's my interest.
Yeah.
So these guitars, they're not really like Taylor's vintage guitar. They're not really like a copy of anything.
Yeah.
They're just fun to play.
Yeah.
It's like the best way to evaluate it is pick it up and play it.
Yeah.
Play a song on it. Do you like the way it sounds? Does it fit you well? Is it fun?
Yeah.
That's the mark of a good instrument.
So I mentioned resources earlier. You guys have a tremendous array of artists to work with or to probably send for bouncing off ideas and stuff. Who has seen these, if you're able to talk about it? And was there an evolution of this guitar? Did somebody in Nashville or somewhere else go like, actually, you need to do this?
Well, not so much that, because I really like just making things and handing them to musicians and saying, I'm not going to tell you much about this. Just go and play it.
Sure.
And then a couple of weeks from now, call me and it works or it doesn't for you.
Yeah.
So I built a couple and I played them. And George Gruen's been he's become a good friend over the last number of years. And it's really enjoyable because I grew up reading his books and articles.
Sure.
And yeah, he really did a lot for the guitar playing community in those ways. He's always been very generous with his knowledge and resources. So I let him play one of the couple of the early versions of it. And he got through like a chord and went, this one.
Okay.
You guys got to make this one. Went, really? He goes, yeah, nothing else exists like this, but musicians could use it.
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, that's kind of what I think too. I think people would have fun with this. So I was thinking like, well, you know, the traditional guys will like it.
Okay.
You know, some of the bluegrass players and the songwriters. And they did. So I'd send a few of them to different people, you know, let them try it. One of the strangest things, though, I started getting curious, and I would send one to way more modern style players.
Okay.
Like I sent one to Edge.
Okay. You know,
in Dallas's tech, we've been working with some different guitars for a number of years now. So I call him up and call, Dallas, I'm going to send you this thing. Just give this a go. And he gets it. He goes, man, can you send me a backup? Because this one's going to go in the show. This one's like it. I go, really? He goes, yeah, but you know our world. I can't live without a backup. I go, okay, well, I'll start making another. Sorry, yeah. I can't get it to you tomorrow. But I'm like, wow. So here's like one of the most modern guitar players ever going, yeah, this is the flavor I like. Oh, okay.
Did he use it?
Yeah.
It's on
been
video?
Using it.
Yeah. Cool.
And then some of the fingerstyle players started getting into him. You know, well, it's a big body, kind of wide-ish waist, and that doesn't usually fit the fingerstyle players very well. Those guys were having fun playing it. I went, that's kind of fun.
Yeah.
And what's so interesting to me now is that every one of those players who's tried these, no matter how diverse the styles, they come back to them and go, this feels like home.
Hmm.
It feels familiar in the way that all these old records kind of influenced where we become or how we become musicians.
Yeah.
It feels familiar, but in a way that nothing else has been. Because it doesn't sound like anyone, it's not like an old guitar in so many ways. It's a new modern instrument with good intonation and balance and volume and projection, all these things.
Mm-hmm.
But it has this different personality that kind of pulls up a different feeling.
Yeah.
Elicits a different response from a musician.
Yeah. You guys are so damn consistent and your guitars are also playable out of the box. That I guess I take some things for granted, just assume certain things. There's like a baseline when it comes to Taylor. But in terms of this particular guitar, is that feeling really just the combination of the body shape and the V bracing, or is there a lot more going on that we haven't even thought about or discussed?
There's lots of little parts. I mean, you could build a guitar for the first time and probably get 80% of the way there.
Yeah.
If you were paying attention, I wasn't as a kid, so mine broke.
But, sure.
You know, your first guitar actually worked, which is cool. But every time you make a step, you double your efforts and get a smaller return for that work. So you double your efforts and you get 90% of the way there. You double your efforts, you get 95% of the way there.
Yeah.
Double your efforts and you get to like 96 or, you know.
Yeah.
It's like this diminishing returns thing. So in these guitars, there's a whole bunch of little details that felt like moving mountains in a factory.
Okay.
That seem like tiny, minuscule things that matter so much. They matter so much. Like this neck shape is a different shape than what Taylor typically does.
It's a great neck. Yeah.
I like it. It's super comfy.
Yeah.
Okay. There's a whole bunch of little details that make it so. For one, it's not symmetrical.
Okay.
Okay. One of the things that I've thought about for a long time that seems weird is when you play low on the fingerboard, you tend to wrap your hand, you wrap your thumb around the fingerboard a bit more.
Yeah.
Right? So some people will even use that thumb to fret notes on the low end.
Sure.
But we all wrap our thumb.
Yeah.
Okay, so down here, something vaguely like a V shape is usually pretty comfortable.
In the first three, four positions. Yeah.
It's nice.
Yeah.
By the time you get high on the fingerboard, like up by the 10th, 12th, 14th, 15th frets, nobody wraps their thumb anymore.
Yeah.
You put your thumb in the middle of the neck.
Yeah.
Up here, V isn't so comfortable. So typically guitars get made with a pretty consistent profile over the neck.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't make a ton of sense to me because my hand isn't consistent as I go up.
Hmm.
So this neck is like an ever so slight rounded off V down by the nut and becomes very round up by the heel. So as it transitions, it just kind of always feels about right. Feels good. The edges of the fingerboard are treated differently because it's not really like one surface meeting another.
Yeah.
At least on this guitar, it's more of a single surface that takes this kind of rounded off shape.
Cap.
So yeah. So the edges of the fingerboard are actually rolled into the playing surface. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of tricky to do because it's not just a consistent shape that a computer can cut.
Yeah.
Well, it's not like just a linear pattern because it's got to dip in between frets a little bit. Kind of feels like a guitar that's been refretted a couple of times.
Yeah.
And you kind of take the corners off the fingerboard as you go. Every time they get filed and polished down, it's...
So what does the process for that even look like? Are you making the blank out of something that then gets scanned by a computer? Like, I'm trying to figure out how it goes
from... We are working on some of that, actually. Some laser scanning and things.
With like I picture like a spokeshave. I don't even know what I picture, but like something archaic. And then how does that get translated into... No,
it's a mix of really high-tech machining and really good training.
Yeah.
So you can teach a person to sand, but it's really difficult to teach them to sand a certain way, a certain amount, look for a certain scratch pattern to get something right.
Got it.
In that way. So this is a mix of really careful handwork.
Okay.
And really high-tech computer work.
Okay. And is that, I mean, your arguments for that neck make perfect sense. Is that something that's going to leave this particular model and show up in other guitars or TBD?
Well, not
or?
Today. It's really hard to do. Okay. So with any of these things, we make them and we like to put instruments in the hands of musicians. So we'll start it, make it and go, oh, we can only do a few of these. So let's just do a few of them.
Mm-hmm.
Or we can do more of these. Okay, well... If musicians really love them and this fits, sure, it can get adapted into other things.
Yeah.
But we cross that bridge when it comes to it.
Yeah. And in terms of this new model, woods, what are the choices here?
Pretty straightforward. These are Sitka, this one's Sitka with mahogany.
Mm-hmm.
This one's a 517.
Yep.
Pretty conventional mahogany. Mahogany's kind of the top of your list as far as desirable woods.
Yeah.
It's really good for pretty much everything.
Yeah.
That one right there, that one's Sitka on top with East Indian rosewood on the back and sides.
Yeah.
it's nothing surprising in so many ways. Like, there's nothing new here.
Yeah.
They're guitars. They're acoustic guitars. They play songs. They're made from fairly conventional woods. But the sound that comes out of it is just a really unique thing.
Yeah. Well, they're fantastic.
Well, thanks. I've been having a lot of fun with them. I mean, there's little bits and pieces that are hard to do, but these are within the kind of within the realm of what musicians can use. You know, yeah. They're not crazy precious. They're not crazy expensive. They're not outlandish. You know, but all these little details, like the edges of the body, are all really carefully rounded off.
Yeah.
Because I don't like sharp corners. Usually when I touch sharp things, I end up spilling blood somewhere. Yeah, I don't like that, you know.
Sure.
A lot of guitar makers really value their sharp corners
yeah.
on headstocks and things. Go, yeah. You know, it's not really that comfortable to play on.
Yeah.
It's not that comfortable to hold.
Yeah.
I don't really love this. Mm-hmm. You know, so these ones, all the body's all kind of smoothed off. It has a different bridge, so there's no points on yeah. the bridge wings, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's a little more comfortable in your hand.
So, NAMM is coming up as of this recording. It's a few weeks away.
Yeah.
And I can't help but notice when you talk about V-bracing, it sounds like V-bracing or V-class bracing was around years before the public or I ever heard of it. So what's going to be like NAMM 2022? What's going on?
This is a really fun era to be building stuff because there's all these things that I've been working on in the shop that I'll make, I'll try it. And it feels like it's almost scary because of what it would someday do.
Okay.
But in a really exciting way. That's too far out. We're not there yet.
Yeah.
Or this one, I need some more time to think about that one. Like even this guitar, this Grand Pacific was the guitar that I initially had thought of when I was thinking of the V design.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so different than what we're known for, mm-hmm. and in a way, so it would feel like too much of a departure.
Yeah.
It made a lot more sense to let those guitars sit around, play them, refine them, kind of digest them a little more, and then introduce that idea in like a way more modern context.
Sure.
So that people have a frame of reference.
Yeah.
You know, so we initially came out with the Grand Auditorium guitars. You go, okay, this is built to be a very Taylor sound. It is a Taylor modern guitar sound.
Sure.
But with this cool sustain, this cool intonation, this volume, it's kind of like a turbocharged feeling Taylor sound. Great. Everybody got it? We're good? Familiar territory. Now we're going to toast for something totally different.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Here's something that's not you wouldn't normally associate with us.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of flavor. So some of those projects that are a little ways out,
yeah,
you kind of have to lead up to it.
All right.
You know, it'd be too much out of left field to really go there right the minute you think of it.
You know a ton of musicians. I'm sure your phone is always ringing from, I don't know, insert famous musician here. You probably field a ton of requests, many of which are totally impractical and will never see the light of day. What is the number one thing that people call you and are like, why don't Taylor do this? And you're like, yeah, this will never happen.
You know, I bet you the most common one I hear is, why don't you build a uke?
Yeah.
And you know what? I really want to.
Yeah.
I'm sure it'll happen at some point. Yeah. I love building ukuleles.
Yeah.
They're super fun instruments.
Yeah.
It's like the perfect gateway instrument for a kid. It's really fun for a guitar player.
Yeah.
A lot of really great musicians make cool music with them.
Yeah.
So someday we'll do one of those.
A uke?
Yeah.
All right. That's a good answer, I guess.
So
yeah.
I get that a lot.
Okay.
I've seen some pretty bizarre ones.
Okay. Let's hear them. You don't have to name the artist.
There is one that I thought was bizarre. It was actually in my pre-Taylor days.
Okay.
San Diego has a bunch of really great musicians.
Yeah.
Like some of just the world's great players come to live there. There's a local guy named Peter Sprigg.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Peter, yeah.
Amazing musician. Wonderful human being. He came to me asking for this guitar that was a double neck that's like half electric archtop, half classical guitar with percussion pickups mounted in the body and guitar synth, like hexaphonic output guitar synth drivers for both necks, like all, I mean, all this stuff, right? So he came over to my shop and he's going, man, I really want, could you make an instrument like that? And I'm thinking, oh man, I don't know, Peter, this is, you sure? Really? Really? You want what? You know?
Yeah.
So I go, okay, well, thinking, well, if he's asking for it, he probably knows what he wants. So I'll build it, right? So I built that guitar for him.
Okay.
It took me forever. It was really hard to make, really hard to figure out. And a couple of months after it was done, he invited me to this show. He had written all this incredible music for a string quartet plus a jazz trio. And he was playing in San Diego. And I went and listened to him, and my jaw was just on the floor the whole time. I kid you not, he used every sound that possibly could have come out of that instrument in the course of these couple of pieces of music he'd written.
Wow.
I went, okay, well, I get it. I am overruled. Yeah. Wow. That was just amazing. There's no way I could have seen you getting all of that incredible music out of that one curious contraption. It was just mind-blowing.
Wow.
So nowadays, a lot of times when somebody, a musician will ask for something kind of outlandish.
Yeah.
I'm not really inclined to say no anymore.
Yeah.
A lot of times they got something cool up their sleeve. I mean, I can't always do it. I try when I can, but a lot of times when people come with crazy ideas, I go, well, that may not be so crazy.
Yeah.
It might be a little unconventional, but that's the way musicians are, and I think that's pretty good.
Yeah.
I think that's how a lot of good music gets written.
For sure. You, I know you get to kind of work to a certain extent in a little bit of a vacuum. You don't have to worry about some of the stresses that a typical luthier working in his home shop has to worry about. You've got a big company behind you. But you are definitely aware of trends, and I'm sure you go to NAMM or whatever. Like, what's your sense if we were able to look in a crystal ball of, like, where do you think things are headed in the guitar world in the next 5 to 10 years?
Man, that's a good question. I bet you're going to see a lot more, if I could use the word, interdisciplinary music being made.
Okay.
Where people are, they're not just stealing from different genres and mixing them. It's almost like they're distilling different genres and morphing them together into something different.
Yeah.
And so you look at a musician who's playing, let's say, a traditional mandolin or a guitar, and they're doing it next to a computer with synthesized sounds.
Sure.
And making some really cool stuff.
Yeah.
And they're doing this collage recording where you might not be doing a single take on a tune. You're kind of making a collage piece of music.
Sure.
Like the Beatles pioneered with some of their overdubbing work. And I think we are going to see a lot more mixing of styles. You know, it's not, like I said, it's not just playing in one style, playing in another. It's like you're taking something and redefining what that thing is.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's interesting.
I think that's pretty exciting.
I follow, I don't know why, but I follow Moby on Instagram. And
cool.
Every video he's posted almost for the last several months is just him with an acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
And it almost seems like, okay, well, you can do that. Like, is it going to connect with the dots with the old Moby that we all like got hooked on 15 years ago?
Yeah.
I
imagine you'll see it go both ways.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot bigger proliferation of music that's happening.
Yeah.
I mean, music is, it's pretty weird because it's like the one art form that doesn't have a fixed medium.
Yeah.
Right. So think of it this way. Art is like, most art forms are decoration. They're decoration of a space specifically. So it would be like a painting or a sculpture or architecture. Mm-hmm. You're decorating a space. Because of that, there's a tangible thing attached to it.
Sure.
Right? music is like decorating time as it goes by. Mm-hmm. Right? So all these other art forms are decorating space, but music just decorates passing time. It doesn't have a fixed medium that it comes in. So because of that, it's historically been kind of tricky to do commerce with it.
Yeah.
You know, the first forms were printed sheet music.
Yeah.
You know, whether it was handwritten originally or then printed, you've got your wax cylinders, you've got your shellac discs, you've got vinyl, you've got 8-tracks and cassette and stereo, like all these different formats, CDs. But this last change is pretty weird because it transitioned back from a tangible thing that you could hold in your hand to an intangible thing.
Yep.
Now it's more like information that gets handed around.
Yeah.
But it's not attached to a fixed medium.
Yeah.
So because of that...
Unless you still get a paper Visa statement and you do the $9.95 Spotify. Yeah.
Totally. And so a lot of musicians are exploring a lot of different avenues of how do I share music?
Yeah.
What form does it come in?
Yeah.
I see a lot more live music than I did even a few years ago.
Sure.
A lot of people are going back to playing gigs locally.
Yeah.
And that's great. Some people are doing YouTube things or Instagram things. They're not making records in the way that we would have 30 years ago or 20 years ago or 50 years ago. It's kind of this different landscape that musicians are living in. So now it's really fascinating and a really exciting time to watch what musicians do next, because some of them, like Moby, take an acoustic guitar, you've got a great song, you can present it in a really simple way.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
There's a very real experience with that.
Yeah.
You know, the music making experience is a very vital part of the human existence.
Yeah.
And in other ways, people are mixing influences and mixing computers and sounds and synthesizers and acoustic instruments and drums and all these things to make some incredible artwork.
Yeah.
So it's really fascinating. I have no idea what will happen next.
Yeah.
I'm excited for it.
Yeah. I'm sure you guys have a better glimpse at real world numbers than most of us do. Do you get a sense, that it's the guitar universe is starting to grow again, or is it shrinking? Or I know, there was that famous study that half of all guitar buyers are females when it comes to Fenders. I think that was, but what's your sense of like where the whole thing is at in the industry?
I think that people really like playing music.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I think a lot of instruments are hard to learn.
Yeah.
But I think a good number of people see the value in that.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to see something like a guitar specifically or an acoustic guitar travel over like worldwide.
Sure.
And be adopted by other cultures and other nations. I mean, 10 years ago, I don't know that we had sold even one guitar in China.
Yeah.
But now there is a huge guitar playing population in China, like enormous.
Yeah.
It's hilarious, but in a way for the modern world, it's kind of a strange role reversal, but a lot of the guitars that we're making are now not flowing from China to the US.
Yeah, I was just
going
to say,
going the other way,
everybody always, their gripe, oh, Chinese made guitars. Yeah, so now Chinese are actually buying American guitars.
Wow, that's kind of interesting to see how things shift. But it's incredible to see the way something like sharing a song.
Yeah.
It comes and goes, and people still love to sit down with an instrument, play a song, and include that as part of their lifestyle.
Yeah.
Like in my case, I still play some gigs. I play on some recordings from time to time.
Sure.
A big chunk of what I play is for my kids.
Mm-hmm.
I play around the house. I play while they fall asleep. I like playing music. I just like the sounds that come out of these. I like to when people tell their stories.
Yeah.
To me, that's worth it. That's important.
Yeah.
That matters. That's a significant part of life.
Yeah.
You know, that's a good reason to pick up a guitar and play, is because your kids want to hear a song.
Yeah.
Or maybe you're playing at a coffee shop, or maybe you're playing at a bar or a club or something. People should be playing music.
Yeah.
They should be telling their stories and making their songs.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. It's really exciting. I think the guitar world will continue to grow because it's pretty tough to replace this thing.
Yeah.
It's portable. It's not terribly difficult to learn how to play some songs.
Yeah.
Well, it's a lot of different styles.
Say what you want about Taylor, and there are millions of fans and some folks who are like, I don't, you know, it's too modern or whatever, but like, it is one of the most playable acoustic guitars you could ever ask for, whether Thanks. You're starting out or have been playing for years. I mean, it's, you know, it's a very easy guitar to play.
Yeah. Well, if it's not fun to play, then no musician's going to use it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the, kind of the cold hard truth is if you pick it up, no exotic wood, no cool specifications, no rare this or exclusive that. Nothing will make up for the fact that it either is or is not fun to play.
Yeah.
So you look at these guitars, like I love the Waterloo guitars that our Texas friends make.
Yep.
They're super fun to play.
For sure.
I like the guitars that we're making. They're fun to play.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cool instruments.
What's the last guitar you bought that you didn't had nothing to do with the making of?
That's been a while.
Has it? I guess when you have access to...
You know, at one point in my life, I had a pretty good collection going.
Yeah.
Because I would, in the pre-internet days, I'd look around at like classifieds and things and find, you know, those sort of cryptic ads.
Sure.
You go, blonde old Gibson guitar.
Yeah.
Need to sell to pay for roommate's rent, you know.
Yeah.
That's a winner, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, I ended up with a mid-50s ES-175 from that exact ad.
Oh, good. Nice.
So I had a pretty good collection, and I mostly sold them because I realized I wasn't playing them, and I had built some guitars that I really liked playing.
Yeah.
I have I've got a K hollow body bass.
Okay.
That I bought back when I was in college. A classmate had brought it to class one day. He goes, hey, can you fix this? Because in my college days, I spent most of my time building and selling guitars and fixing guitars. He's like, can you fix this up and make it play? Well, it had a lot of stuff that was wrong with it. It was not a playable thing.
This is not an upright bass.
No, I forget the model number, but it has this cool, like, it's a single cutaway hollow body thing.
Okay.
Kind of Dan Electro flavor with this checkered binding. I'm like, man, I'm sorry. This one's, it's going to cost more to fix than to buy another one.
Yeah.
So okay, well, do you want it? I go, well, I don't want to just take it. He's like, well, how much money do you have in your wallet? I open it up. I'm like, I have $6. You know? He's like, I'll take it. That'll buy me lunch. You keep the bass.
Yeah.
I go, okay, well, I don't know what I'll do with it. Well, I ended up refretting it and fixing the neck up and got everything working. Darn if it doesn't sound really cool.
Wow.
It was super fun to play.
Yeah.
I ended up playing on the Tonight Show as a bass player with that. And I think Ellen DeGeneres show. I was playing with this British singer. It's a really good soul R&B kind of flavor.
Yeah. Not bad for $6.
Yeah. Like, man, this thing's really fun to play. This last year I came into, I haven't had a piano in years. And so I kind of ended up with this, with a really cool old Baldwin Grand.
Wow.
So I got that put into the barn and kind of sits somewhat dusty next to the bandsaw. So it's in the workshop there. Sounds great in there. So I've been playing a lot of piano lately.
Nice.
It's been fun to have that again.
What, we talked about Collings, Waterloo, but, what builders as a builder do you kind of look at, you know, when you're searching around the internet or going to guitar shows or whatever, and you're like, these guys are doing some pretty cool stuff. Like,
I think most of them.
Most of them, okay.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds, I don't want to sound like a politician.
Yeah.
But I love guitar makers.
Yeah.
They're building music making things.
Yeah.
I mean, they're like these incredible magic boxes.
Yeah.
That people get to make songs with. And as a guitar maker, I realized this is really dang hard.
Yeah.
It is hard to build a guitar.
Yeah.
It's really tricky. So when somebody's going to make something and they go to that trouble to get good at it and have a vision for something and make it, I applaud that effort. Mm-hmm. I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
So there's, I mean, of course I've got guitar making friends.
Sure.
I mean, Michael Gurian here. He's a great builder.
Yeah.
Of course, people know him mostly as Perfling guy. He's a good builder.
Yeah.
You know, of course, Bill Collings was a good friend.
Yeah.
But he had a great crew of guys who are all really good builders. Dana Bourgeois, of course.
Yeah.
Richard Hoover. I mean, I don't want to start naming names because I'm afraid that I'll leave some friends out.
Those were solid names, yeah.
But there's a lot of really great builders
yeah.
who are doing really cool work.
All right. Well, Andy, this guitar, the Grand Pacific, comes out, or it'll be announced at NAMM. So when will the public see it? Soon?
Pretty quick after that. Yeah, we've been building and shipping them for the last number of weeks, maybe a couple months.
All right.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
This was fun.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.